This is Storycatcher with Patricia Glynn. Welcome to Inspirations, stories that go deeper with people who go further. We're stepping into the world of Southern Africans who are truly exceptional. And because they're living big and asking the big questions, our conversations here are longer than those on Potpourri. Hello again from the cradle of humankind. Inspirations this month comprises two parts, both recorded here in Alexandra, my truck, parked right outside my tent, because my tent sounds as if it's about to take off. The wind is so bad. Anyway, two parts, two very different angles on the great paleoanthropological stories that have unfolded in the valleys around here. In part one, Vincent Carruthers, who has been writing and lecturing about this area for many decades, gave us the stories, the very dramatic stories, of the creatures that have been unearthed here and how they've contributed to our understanding of how we evolved into who we are today. You don't need to listen to part one in order to access part two, but we ended the story with Vincent of Lee Berger, South Africa's premier paleoanthropologist, poised to make the greatest discovery of his life, and that was the discovery of Homo naledi. Now, the discovery of naledi is definitely the most exciting of the cradle's exciting stories, in my opinion. It would make for a thrilling movie a la Raiders of the Lost Ark, and perhaps that'll happen one day. But the potential of this tense underground drama was spotted by Netflix, who produced a documentary about it called Unknown, Cave of Bones. Lee Berger's account of it is in his book, Almost Human, and if anything, it's even more riveting. Anyhow, someone who's been intimately involved with the bringing of Homo naledi into the light from its dark cavern 30 meters beneath the surface is Dr. Kenilwe Molopiane. She's one of Lee Berger's so-called underground astronauts, the women, and they were almost exclusively women, that he selected to go down and lift this treasure out of the cave in which it had lain for 300,000 years. He chose women because they had the petite physiques to cope with the very tight spaces which they would have to navigate to get to the Chamber of Bones. I met Kenilwe at the very busy and noisy camp where scientists are working on the Gladysvale material. She's the director of the Gladysvale dig. The site is hardly high-tech. It's little more than a collection of wooden huts where technicians painstakingly separate fossils from the concrete-like breccia in which they have solidified thousands or even millions of years ago. I propped up my mic on a large vat of something labeled dangerous chemicals, and we chatted. Okay, so where to start? Let's start with Netflix, the docu, because that's put you on the map, didn't it?
Yeah, I guess it has. The Netflix docu has sort of become a popular talking point these days. Every time I meet someone new, it's like, hey, I saw you on the TV. And I'm like, oh God, okay.
Well, you know, really, it's one way to get your name out there. And I think the pink hair helped. Or is it red hair? Or is it
purple hair? It's burgundy.
Burgundy.
It's a burgundy colour.
Burgundy. Because yes. Down there in the cave, it was difficult to tell, you know, what colour it really
was. Yeah, because I had a helmet on the entire time. Safety first.
Yeah, indeed, safety first. The potential for a bad accident on this project was high. And it's important to understand how challenging this dig was. They're still working down there on and off. If you haven't read Lee Berger's book or seen the Netflix documentary, I would recommend you pause this and take a look at the map of the Rising Star Cave system, which is attached to the podcast, along with some photos of Kenilwe and her hominin friends. As you'll see, there is a long series of interlinked caves and passages which the underground astronauts had to navigate, culminating in an extremely challenging obstacle which they called the chute. So Lee was looking for a very particular set of skills in the petite people he used for the dig. Kinilwe had a degree in biological anthropology, not paleoanthropology, but she was a class 4 scuba diver. She was comfortable underwater, therefore, and could handle herself in situations that had no easy means of escape.
That skill of being able to deal with that sort of environment would become a key thing for the Rising Star application. Because I didn't have any climbing experience. I didn't have any spelunking experience. I was just an archaeologist and I could dive.
So instead of you and Blackwater, now it was you and Blackrock. What I wondered, having seen the documentary, is if they did any tests as to your propensity to handle claustrophobia. Did they?
Yes. Okay, so just to backtrack a little bit. So I was part of the second group of underground astronauts, as we were known as. So I joined the Rising Star team in 2017. So I was the second group that went in, which the second team was mostly local scientists. And you go through the whole interview process and, you know, sitting down in a room being interviewed by like one of the original underground astronauts and an operations manager is nerve-wracking on its own. The true test, after being shortlisted and selected, was a recce tour of the cave. So you had the experienced cavers take you through the Rising Star cave system, going into very difficult squeezes and tight spaces and being in the dark, just to see if you are able to actually make the traveling route to the chamber and still be calm enough to do the work. So you might say, yes, sure, I'm not claustrophobic, I could totally do it. And then they put you in the situation where you might just panic a little bit. So there was a little bit of a exercise in the beginning to see if you have what it takes. And I guess I passed the test.
I guess. And everyone thinks that, not everyone.
Most people.
A lot of people think that chute that is referred to is almost, you know, like a foofy slide. But it's not. It is jagged and it is black. Mm-hmm. And it is very lonely down there, I would think.
Yes, but it's not. It's literally a crack in the ground. And you're standing over the opening of the chute. And you look down and you're like, there's no way my body's going to get in there. But at some point, you stop thinking you have to do it. And so you slowly lower yourself into this hole in the ground, this crack in the rock. And then you realize, okay, this is not a simple, we're going down. Like you said, it's jagged rocks, sharp ones that are pointing out everywhere. There's this point called the pinnacle point, where if you're not careful, you could seriously impale yourself. And that's where the smallest space in the chute is. You know, you're doing all these movements to get through the chute, which is an indicator that it's not a simple trip. And only one person at a time could be in the chute labyrinth, which is now what we're referring it to, at a time. And so it's very tight. It's very easy to get stuck in there. I've been stuck in there and it's super, super tight. And this is the moment where you have to be calm. In a time where you think you're going to panic, you don't have time to panic. You have to be calm to get yourself out. And there's always people above or below you who are willing to guide you as best as they can. But again, it's a solo trip and you have to rely on your skills to get through it.
And you know, when you get to the bottom, you've got possibly the greatest rewards known to paleoanthropology to date.
Yes. So when you eventually climb out from the chute labyrinth and you hit the ladder and you go and sit down to get ready to prepare, it's almost like you have this sense of relief. Okay, I made it. I'm here. And then the excitement picks up because you sort of remember where you are, right? And you're in a space where it's just hominid material.
That's lots of it.
Lots of it.
Like thousands of bones.
Lots of it. And still so much more that's down there. Also, you're in a space that not a lot of people have been in or will ever be in.
So, not people like me.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe we'll get you in there. Might no, get stuck
you.
A little bit, but
no, thank you. Very
oh, come
much.
On. Yeah, I mean, it's a very special space. It's almost like a feeling you can't quite describe. The smell that you
is
what
it a,
you see
is it a rotten smell or
no? It's not a rotten smell. it's almost like it's like this damp smell, but it's not there all the time. But you smell the moisture, and then you acclimatize you to the environment all of a sudden.
Is it very hot down there?
It's not very hot. It's actually a steady 16 degrees, so it's really cool, like most caves in the cradles. So I'm a small person, so I get cold quite quickly. So I'm always with my jumper that I keep in my bag because we excavate for many, many hours underground. And so we spend the whole day excavating because making that trip up and down to go to the loo is not worth it. So you hold your pee, bro.
Really? You
Yeah,
don't have a little bucket in
no,
the
there's no
corner.
bucket because then it's going to stink. And then who's going to take the bucket out?
Quite right.
Yeah.
Quite right. So it's almost like a reverence, it's awe that you're feeling surrounded by that. And if you start imagining what you do, I'm sure looking at these bones, you start imagining what these creatures were doing down there. They're very small-brained
Yes,
creatures.
that's the thing about home ladies, that they have almost modern-like bodies, but their brain capacity is very, very small, which is not normal for the time period in which they're occurring in, where you have Neanderthals almost at the same time, roughly, and you know they have a big brain capacity, and then you have Homo naledi with this very small brain capacity. But it seems like they're doing complex behavior. I mean, we don't know. These are just a working hypothesis that we're dealing with. But I think the interesting question with Homo naledi is, okay, the way that they look, why is it the way they are? And what are they doing in this cave system? How did they get there? And why is it only Homo naledi that we're finding in the Rosetta Stone cave system?
So, very, very many questions and so few answers. But Lee had an opinion which started up the usual academic ruckus, as Vincent Carruthers says.
He came to the conclusion that this must have been a ceremonial burial site, or perhaps not ceremonial, but certainly a burial site where bodies were brought and dumped. And he put that theory out, and it has been absolutely denied by other people who've gone to a lot of length to show that it wasn't the way he described it, wasn't a burial site. You see, if it is a burial site 200,000 to 300,000 years ago, it precedes any known ceremony, religious ceremony of any kind, or even purposeful burial in the whole human line. The first time we know of any artwork or burial or ceremony or any kind of spiritual recognition is probably at the earliest 70,000 or 80,000 years ago. This is 300, and it is not an ancestor of humans. These Homo naledi did not become Homo sapiens.
Oh, really? I hadn't understood
Yeah,
that.
no,
Oh.
they because Homo sapiens was already had already evolved.
Aha.
So this species, which is quite different looking and a different brain, a different animal altogether, could not have evolved into something that had already evolved. So there are lots and lots of unanswered questions. And the main one is the cultural one. You know, was this what Lee suspects that it was?
I think it's a great conversation to have in the sciences, this whole back and forth, be like, you haven't presented enough evidence that it's deliberate burial. And so, you know, you need to go back and to collect as much evidence as you possibly can because you can't generate evidence, right? You just have to work with what is there, and which we've done. We've worked with what is there. And you know, you present it as best as you can, and then it's just up to the audience to be like, okay, fine, you've done the job well, or if we haven't done the job well, it's just like, well,
Yeah, you'll get
at
ripped to
this
shreds.
point,
That is paleoanthropology. You
yeah.
rip each other to shreds all the time. Well, maybe not your generation. I hope not, because those who preceded you have been involved in some very ungentlemanly fights, not squabbles, fights. But I just want to get back to these creatures. They were tiny, so they could have got down the chute a bit easier than you did.
Yes. Oh, well, I mean, the chute is our only entrance to the Dina Lady Chamber at the moment. This does not mean that there might not be another entrance into this chamber. It doesn't mean that perhaps the Dina Lady chamber might have been bigger than what we think it is, and there's just been a collapse somewhere, making it much smaller. So there's lots of room for investigation into really understanding the cave system and how it has formed and how it has changed over time. But just based on the physique of Hermana Lady, yes, going down the chute labyrinth would have been easy.
Even with a dead body in, even with, carrying.
Yeah, even with the dead body. I'm not saying that it wouldn't have been difficult. Probably would have still been difficult, but I don't think they would have struggled as much as we do.
Yeah, and the big controversy is whether these creatures were burying their dead, you know, in a manner which seemed to... it's a very busy little scientific camp you've got here. burying their dead in a way that, that indicated that they had some kind of acknowledgement of an afterlife. But that is one of the theories that is being tested, so there's not much point in us discussing it, correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's out of my wheelhouse.
What is your wheelhouse is the Gladys Vale site.
Yes.
Which has always been a bit of a Cinderella site. You know, it was never as sexy because it was it was like Noah's Ark.
A Noah's Ark in the sense that Gladys Vale has so far yielded the fossils of animals, not hominids. In the first few decades of the 1900s, the site attracted the interest of some of the greats of South African paleoanthropology, like Robert Broom, Frank Peabody, Philip Tobias. Then the cave fell silent for four decades and lay waiting for someone to reopen it to the world. That someone was Kinelwe's boss, Lee Berger.
And then, you know, in the 1990s, Lee would come along and he was like, okay, give me a chance to be a field person and try to find fossils. And so he started working at Gladys Vale from 1990 to the early 2000s.
And he found two teeth.
Yes, he found
two teeth. And in your world, that's enough to lighten everything up again.
Yes, I mean, these like two teeth are significant, right? Because they're not ordinary teeth.
Why?
They are hominid teeth, so teeth of a hominid. And at the time, this was in 1991-92, they were classified as Australopithecus africanus, which is an early hominid in southern Africa. And it's the same type of hominid that you find at Sterkfontein. It's the same hominid that the Taung child is. And so he found these two teeth, and it was the first time a hominid had been found in, say, about 40 years since the discovery of Mrs. Place at Sterkfontein. So it was big news. We'd be like, okay, this is definitely a hominin fossil bearing site. We're going to keep working at it. We're going to find the rest of this hominin. And, you know, we're going to put Gladys Vale on the map. And Lee worked at the site for a good 17 years, you know, for all of his efforts and with his students and all the people that have worked at Gladys Vale over the years. They didn't find the rest of the hominin.
That's an understatement. They didn't even find the rest of the jaw.
No, they didn't. It was just the two teeth, the lower two teeth that came out of it. But, you know, during all their efforts, I mean, hundreds, thousands of other fossils were recovered, all animals. But these animals are quite significant because they tell a story of the environment of the cradle at certain points in our history. So you have lots of equids, bovids, so your buck, zebras, carnivores, hyenas. I think there's even a wolf, a giant wolf that came from Gladys Vale. I describe it as Noah's Ark because it seems like there's so many animals in this one space, which is incredible for any site in the cradle.
And as I understand it, because it's stratified, you get a very, very good idea of what was happening when. And you can look at, say, the development of a horse.
Yes.
And you can get a very good idea of what the landscape looked like, what their prey looked like. Well, I don't know, does a horse have prey? Did it ever have prey?
What is prey? I mean, that's the idea. Theoretically, that's the idea. So Gladys Vale has this very long stratigraphy in it, which is perfectly preserved. It's great. But our understanding of the timeline of Gladys Vale isn't quite clear yet. I mean, I am collaborating with a geologist at the moment who will be able to help me and sort of putting dates to stratigraphic regions based on the fossils that we're finding. So we're able to get a clearer vision of the timeline of Gladsville and what the environment might have looked like about 1.3 million years ago when Australopithecus africanus was on the landscape. That's the idea.
And it sounds to me, as a layperson, that the sexiest thing that's come out of Gladsville, apart from the two teeth, of course, is a huge hyena-type, wolf-type thing, and that its scat has some hair of a hominid. So this hair was found, and was it Homo hair?
Yes, like you said, there's a Pachycrocruda.
What?
Pachycrocruda, which is your giant hyena.
Jolly good.
That was discovered at Gladsville, and there's more of it that I seem to be picking up with my expeditions now.
You mean the hair?
No, the actual fossil.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, the
that's right. Fossil.
Okay. Yes, the bone stuff and the teeth. So
is there hair in the teeth?
No. Sorry.
Let us
disappoint you. Yes. Yes. But yeah, so, you know, they went through the scat or the coprolites, and there was this hair in it. And yes, it does look like a hominid. What hominid or what hominin it could be, we don't know. Because methodology hasn't progressed that far that we'll be able to tell what kind of species this might have been. And then, of course, we need something to compare it to. So hair doesn't survive very well in the fossil record. So to have hair is incredible. But it's not like we could compare it to an Australopith hair because we don't have that.
So the possibility of extracting some DNA from it, is that just...
I mean, I think that's possible.
Oh.
I think it will be possible just based on the way that science is progressing. I'm pretty sure someone will be smart enough and clever enough to come up with something.
How fabulous. Tell me something. I think you said, or I've read somewhere, that there is some new technology being used at Gladsville. Is that correct?
Well, there's a new methodology. We're approaching exploration in a new way. And we're saying new in a sense that not a lot of people do things this way. So, I mean, like I've mentioned, Gladsville is an old site. It had been worked on for like a good 20 years. And so here I come back as a young researcher, and we're going back to a place that has been explored to its highs. And we're taking a look at everything that researchers had done before at the site. So we're going back into their old research piles, and we're taking a good look at the blocks that they might have missed or they have left behind, in hopes that, okay, maybe they just weren't sure as to what it is that they were looking at. And now that we have a better understanding of what hominin skeletons look like, maybe they missed them. So let's go back and check. So we're doing that whole exercise of just having a do-over of all the blocks. So that's the new approach that we're doing. And it's a great exercise because it's sort of trained me in my leadership skills, and that I'm leading a whole team to do this work. I'm also getting my eye in for fossils. So I'm getting exposed to a whole range of fossils that normally I wouldn't have come across. And it's also engaging with the local communities who's working with us in the field and teaching them about the cradle, because they live here. They are the true cradle ambassadors. So it doesn't help that they live next door to this famous site and they have no idea about the history of the region. It's empowering them as well to be proud of where they come from. So that's sort of the new approach, I guess, which is not really new. It's just we're quite intentional about it.
And learning to interpret what you see is really important as in your progression as a scientist. Mm. Because I know that at least one occasion you made a big mistake on what do you call holy shit day.
I have made numerous mistakes.
But that was the big one, wasn't it?
Yes, that was the big one. So, I mean, look, Gladsville, I had such high hopes. I was cocky. And I'm like, yes, I'm going to go into this. And with this new approach that we're having in checking every single block, we're going to find the hominin. And I'm not going to spend 17 years at the site like Lee did. And so we spent a good 6 months working at Glasvale. And I was so tired. I mean, we were living in tents at this point. And I wanted to go home. And this one morning, we were working out on site. And I'm being pulled up to the science tent where the team's like, no, you need to sit down. We have to show you something. And so I'm panicking a little bit because these guys are like edgy. Not sure what happened, but something clearly must have happened. I hear this bustling sound behind me and I look back and it's the entire underground team that's been working in the cave and they're all coming. Everyone is coming towards me and I'm like, oh shit, okay, what is happening here? And then they place a block in front of me. It's a cute little block. And I'm like, okay, cool. I'm turning it around in my hands. And then as I'm turning it, I see a face that is sticking out from the rock and is looking at me. So think back to Robert Broom when he was told that there's a face in the wall. So it was, oh my gosh, maybe I found that face. Yes. And it looked promising. It didn't look like a bovid. It didn't look like anything else that I had seen at that point. It could only have been a hominid. I was so, so sure that I had found that hominid. And we were all so excited. I mean, I was ready to pop the champagne. It was great. And so it went off for fossil preparation, where the fossil preparators would excavate the fossil out of the breccia. And we went from super, super excited that we have a hominid to, oh, it's a primate. It could be a baboon. And Lee's like, oh, no, that's fine. It's still something rare at Glasvale. It's okay. And, you know, the same thing would happen another two times. I mean, the most recent, we found this tooth and it's a beautiful tooth and it looks so promising. It was the right shape, right size. And again, teeth are like golden tickets in this business, right? If you have the right tooth. And again, I was super, super excited. You know, the guys would call me and be like, we found this tooth and it looks amazing. I was like, cool, I'm coming. Put the champagne in the fridge. They prepare the tooth out of the breccia. And it's another primate. And so now the champagne goes out of the fridge and back into storage. So yeah, no, Gladyswell is a place where I'm building character.
Well, I'm sure that's the pattern, though, of discoveries everywhere, isn't
yeah.
it? This high of expectation.
Yeah,
and then this terrible disappointment.
Every now and then, Lee would remind me that, you know, remember that I spent 17 years of nothing. And you started out at Rising Star where every single fossil that you picked up was a hominin. It's not the case for every site. Like, you got to learn patience. And I remember one of my fossil preparators prepared this giant tooth. And it looked like a carnivore tooth. And I remember sending a photograph of it to Lee and be like, hey, this is pretty cool. And he's like, do you think it will fit the one that's in the museum, which is the copy of the Pachycrocruda from the site? So drove over to the Malapa Museum at the Cradle Boutique Hotel, and I just stuck the tooth in the cast, and it's almost like a perfect fit. And I was like, my guy, I think I found the other part of the skull that you discovered 20 years ago. So that's a really cool thing about inheriting a site in a way, right? So it's this connection of the present with the past.
I mean, but that's astounding.
Yeah.
Isn't it? After
no, it's
20
great.
Years, you find the right tooth for the right skull.
See, that's the highs and lows of Glasvale's character building. When you want to give up, it will just give you some little thing. To be like, don't give up on me. I can still make you happy. And then you go through that whole cycle again.
Yeah. You are now in charge of the dig in what they call the Dragon's Back, which is just before the shoot.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And so far, is that revealing anything different? Is it also Naledi from beginning to end? Naledi bones?
So the reason why we started out, or we started excavating in Dragon's Back. So Dragon's Back is a chamber just after Superman's Crawl, which is just before the Dragon's Back ridge that you climb up to get to the start of the chute. And so we used to get kitted up at Dragon's Back. You know, we'd put on our harnesses, hold your breath, and then start the journey up to the chute. And so we were like, what if there's actually some Hermana lady right here in Dragonsback, and we're making this dangerous journey to Dina lady when there might be Hermana lady here. So let's have a couple of test pits just to see what's happening. And so, again, I was given the opportunity to lead that excavation, and so I did, with three young students, all women, again. And then eventually I'd have a male. And we just were opening up squares, and as we were excavating, started noticing some anomalies. And one of them is potentially evidence of a fire in Dragonsback, which I think is quite amped for the name Dragon Fire.
Yeah. This is fire deliberately started down there.
That's the working hypothesis that we have, mm-hmm. that this is small fires that are happening in Dragonsback and potentially elsewhere in the Rosenstahl cave system. Again, this is all something that we're currently investigating. We weren't looking for fire when we actually should have been looking for fire. And then all of a sudden we found it and we're like, oh, okay, what does this mean? Who is making this fire? Is this real fire? You know, these are some of the things that we need to test and to interrogate quite carefully and thoroughly. So I'm looking forward to sort of contributing to that part of the next phase of the Rosenstahl studies.
Well, it would have had to have light down there. So yeah. It does make sense, doesn't it?
Which brings us full circle, really, into what Vincent Carruthers told us about in part one. Bob Brain's discovery of the deliberate use of fire in those valleys long, long before Hermann Naledi used it, or may have used it.
So you're living your best life and your right life, are you?
Yes, I am. I'm living my best life.
And you're going to be doing this for decades?
As long as I'm physically able to, I'll keep on doing it.
Well, let me tell you, the old old guys who are doing it well into their 70s weren't exactly in great shape, so I'm sure you'll be here.
I'll be fine.
You will, and all that will change is the color of your hair. What's next? Blue?
I don't know.
You know, you're very famous for your burgundy hair, so maybe don't change.
Yeah, that. It's my calling card, right? Like,
yeah.
I mean, I have a whole cartoon character designed after me, and she's got red hair.
You're
so
joking.
No, I'm serious. Yeah. Super scientists.
Ah.
Yeah. Yeah, we have trading cards. Super Scientists is a non-profit organization started by Justin Yarrow, who's out in Durban. And his idea was to inspire children to get into science, but African children. And the way that he thought about it is like, let's turn local African scientists into Marvel superheroes. And so, you know, he goes around and he follows people. And if he finds you inspiring, or he thinks that you could be inspiring for a certain science, you know, he'll approach you and you'll be drawn up as this Marvel superhero. You have a card, a poster. And so we had this paleo league with my fellow colleagues, and that was quite well received by the internet. And then from there we produced a comic book, which again was well received, and from the comic book, and now we're doing an animation pilot, which we hope will turn out really well. And then who knows? I mean, I was inspired to go into archaeology from Saturday cartoons. So it
what?
Almost, yeah, The Adventures of Tintin when I was 7 years old. And so if this pilot is a success, it's almost going to be full circle for me, starting off with cartoons to eventually being in a cartoon.
Starting off being inspired and ending up being an inspiration. You can see the title page of that cartoon in the photos attached to Kinilwe's interview on my podcast page. Amazing woman, Dr. Kinilwe Molopiane, underground astronaut for Lee Berger's Homo Naledi project, archaeologist and archaeology lecturer at WITS, head of the Gladys Vale Dig, and one of the National Geographic Society's emerging explorers. Oh, and a Benoni girl, down to earth as they breed them over there. Till next time, thanks for joining us.